now is that, please be seated.
Morning, council. Ready to proceed?
Yes, sir.
May please the court, Mr. Chief Justice, Justice Berger, Justice Ridgely, good morning. I'm Paul Wallace. I am here on behalf of the appellant, the state of Delaware, in this matter. In preparing for this argument, there were many things that I suppose the state wished to try to be critical of the procedures that brought us here I would speak about. But the procedural issues that led to the diminution of Glenn Sloman's sentence is not nearly as important as the core question of when the Superior Court has jurisdiction to change its sentencing judgment. What are the contours of that? What are the statutory rules, or the court rules and statutory rules that govern that? And the state suggests that when that question is answered, really the procedural things could fall by the wayside because they are not nearly as important. And why is that, quote, a big deal? It's a big deal because the state always has an interest in ensuring the enforcement of rules and statutes related to criminal law and public safety. In this case, the state suggests, most importantly, Rule 35 was abrogated. 11 Delaware Code Section 4217 was abrogated or wholly ignored. And how it works with Rule 35, and then various rules relating to the powers of commissioners, the court's own administrative orders relating to that were not really dealt with. The problem is this. The Truth in Sentencing Act of 1989 sought to provide certainty in sentencing. Basically, the premise when the very first paragraph of that purpose was set forth to achieve truth in sentencing by assuring that the public, the state, and the court will know the sentence imposed by the court will be served by the defendant, and the defendant will know what the actual effect of the sentence will be. In other words, when the sentence is imposed, everybody has a good and reasonable level of certitude about what that sentence means.
Could I interrupt for a second?
Of course.
You indicated that the procedures that took place here are not so much the issue as the fact that the sentence was modified. Let's assume that at the very beginning, as I recall, this defendant had a remarkably unpleasant history of DUI, something like 14 prior convictions, and the sentencing judge, I suspect very appropriately, found that kind of a background to be so serious that significant jail time was warranted.
Yes.
Let's assume that this same defendant came before a judge for the first time to be sentenced. No changes in sentence, but for the first time to be sentenced. And the judge looked at it a little bit differently than perhaps I look at it, or perhaps the state would look at it, and said, well, you know, this guy has had 14 DUIs, but we're going to give him another chance. And I'm only going to give him, 6 months, the minimum? I'm going to give him 6 months level 5 time and probation for a bunch of years. Would the state be in a position to do anything other than,
No, we would not, because that sentence would be within the statutory bounds of the sentencing discretion of the judge.
Okay, well, the reason I'm asking that is because as much as I might personally not be happy with what happened here, in the end, a judge entered a modified sentence that was not quite as bad as only 6 months, but was, I'm going to give you a break sentence, which the state, understandably, might feel was much too light a sentence. But still, why does that create an issue that that's properly before this court?
Well, because, Your Honor, the reason for that is, once the judgment is entered, once that sentencing judgment is entered, things take place. Sentencing is always about looking at the person as close to time as the offense as possible. All the sentencing case law basically says that's the best way to deal with it. And it balances numerous things. It balances things like punishment, rehabilitation, deterrent. That judgment is best made at that time of the sentence. And if a judge exercises his or her discretion, for instance, in this case, and says only 6 months, again, the state may strongly disagree with it, but it is a judgment made. When a judge instead, the original sentencing judge, looks at that sentence as close in time as possible, the proper time, when all parties are there, when the arguments of the state and defense are both heard, and says, Mr. Sloman, this is your 14th DUI, you are a menace, and basically he got 3.5 years in jail because he was also a person prohibited from driving. So in actuality, by the time the sentence was reduced, he did get the 6 months minimum because he did 6 months in jail for the person prohibited. He got 6 months for the DUI. Once that judgment is made, everyone has an interest in finality of that. And because it is made at the best possible time, Flamer, for instance, this court has talked about the state's interest in the finality of judgment. And that idea carries through in both the case law of this court, in the ABA standards about judgment, about sentencing changes, the underpinnings of Rule 35, how Rule 35 has been applied time and again by the Superior Court, and that is once that judgment is made, it is deemed to be the best judgment made at the time based on all of the factors. And only in very limited circumstances can you come back to that judgment. The limited circumstances are, one, 90 days within the sentence under Rule 35, and that's basically an open, almost an open market discretion for the judge to say, did I make a mistake here? Is there something I did not take into consideration? But once that 90 days closes, then extraordinary circumstances must be found. And extraordinary circumstances, as defined time and again by this court, or at least what has been taken out of it, is things like exceptional rehabilitation and the like. It is a very, very limited window. And that is consistent with how Rule 35 has worked in the past, fostering that idea of finality and the fact that the original sentencing judgment was the best informed judgment.
Well, shouldn't what's extraordinary be interpreted based on the individual facts of the particular case? It's not automatically... rehabilitation is never extraordinary. But what about a combination of facts which, coupled with rehabilitation, might make it extraordinary?
I would suggest, Justice Ridgely, that unless those lines are very clearly drawn, if we leave that nebulous line, what we end up with is a situation that we have now, and that is just individual judgment as to what extraordinary circumstances are, even though the case law down the line. But let's face it, Sloman, his case for extraordinary circumstances was extremely weak when compared to previous cases that this court has dealt with and the Superior Court has dealt with. Jones, Ketchum, Allen, those guys had actually passed Key also. Sloman hadn't even passed Key yet. He was in it. If you look at the record of what somebody would have had to determine to be extraordinary circumstances, it could only come from that hearing in front of the commissioner in July of 2004, where basically a task officer says he's in Key and he's doing pretty well. That's it. That's the only record of extraordinary circumstances.
Did any of the earlier cases deal with the circumstance? There's statistical information and information known to Superior Court judges, essentially, that the Key Crest continuum, one immediately following the other, is most effective in reducing recidivism. I think Statistical Analysis Center's done that kind of study. Did any of the earlier cases that you're relying on deal with that circumstance where there was a desire to match up the completion of the Key program with the Crest continuum?
It's certainly not clear in the facts of the case, Your Honor. And I suggest it's not clear in this case either. If you truly read that record, that even the task officer says he's in key right now, and we'd like you to modify it so he has to complete key, and then maybe we'll come back later. First of all, the state's greatly troubled by that procedure to begin with. What is a task officer doing bringing modification motions in front of the superior court with no
same thing that a probation officer does?
I suggest it's quite different, Your Honor. A probation officer basically is working and historically has worked as an arm of the court to enforce its orders relating to violations. And there are certain rules that are followed. A person who comes in for a violation of probation has counsel. And in fact, this court most recently, within the last year, has dealt with violations of people's substance abuse programs when, in fact, the person needs to be brought back for some upward departure of his sentence and said, that needs to be done in front of a judge. It needs to be done with counsel there.
But down the ladder ones are done by simple written reports with a judge signing.
They may be. Down the ladder ones are, if you're talking about going from 3 to 2, 2 to 1, things like that, those are specifically statutorily authorized now. In fact, the court wouldn't have to play any part in it anymore after SB 50. Those can be done simply by the Department of Correction. So down the ladder ones are different, and there is statutory authority for it. The problem is there is no statutory authority or rules authority for this. And to say that simply because someone is going to complete key and it is always best, and the state, by the way, does not argue with the fact that it is best that a person go from a program like key into a lower supervised level continuous program. But the problem is that if we permit, and there's ways to do that, if the sentencing order, and we agree with this, there are times when the court certainly should write a sentencing order when it is the court's best judgment.
So are you saying that if this had been done through 4217, the state would not have opposed it?
I don't know.
Didn't you just tell me that you're not arguing with the fact that going from the key to the crest continuum, you're not saying that's a bad idea?
No. If I say nothing else to the court today, what we are saying is, if this is to be done, it should be done through 4217. Absolutely. Those applications based on this type of, if we're assuming that Sloman did great in this program, that it's best to move him down, that's exactly what 4217 is for. That's exactly why it says exceptional rehabilitation. And if you read Rule 35, it says pursuant to Rule 35, or 4217. So it's clear that within the rule is the fact that motions for modification or reduction will be taken through 4217. 4217 specifically says exceptional rehabilitation is one of those reasons. It's inexcusable, as the state suggested in its brief, that they didn't go through 4217. If we left here and got everything we wanted, what we would ask the court to say is, 90 days, open market, the judge has full discretion. After 90 days, extraordinary circumstances, but those are very, very limited, such as the court has held before.
But a task officer has no voice in a 4217 process.
I suggest that's not true. These particular task officers are right there at the Level 5 facility. They're in the Level 5 facility. All the task reports that I have seen, the task officer is speaking with the DOC counselor in charge of that person. There are two different people. There's the task officer, and then there's the DOC counselor.
Only the DOC can make the application to the Board of Parole.
That's true. That is absolutely true.
Mr. Wallace, I'm a little lost here. I thought that the argument is the Superior Court doesn't have the authority to do what it did. It's outside its jurisdiction. It's a clear legal argument. I'm beginning to hear it, and maybe I'm confused, and this is to give you an opportunity to straighten me out. Beginning to hear that this is an abuse of discretion on the part of the Superior Court, that there are extraordinary circumstances under which a sentence can be modified under Rule 35 after 90 days, but these simply are not they. And that this, when the Superior Court suggested that that was the case, the Superior Court got it wrong, and the record doesn't support the Superior Court. So is it this an abuse of discretion, or is this a clear you do not have jurisdiction or authority to enter this order, therefore the order is void?
Well, jurisdiction and authority, and Thank you, Your Honor, because you made my argument much better than I did. It is, the state suggests, the court did not have jurisdiction at the time it acted because no extraordinary circumstances were present.
Okay, now, the person who determines whether there were or were not extraordinary circumstances is the judge, correct?
Under the case law, it has
so,
to be.
Yeah, and your argument is that on this record, it was an abuse of discretion to reach that conclusion because the record simply doesn't support it.
Yeah,
I see where my dilemma is.
I understand, and certainly the case law, for instance, State versus Lewis, says that it has to be the judge who makes that decision about extraordinary circumstances, and that it is a discretionary call to determine whether or not there are extraordinary circumstances. But that's the first step, the state suggests. The court has to find extraordinary circumstances and explicate them before the court has jurisdiction to act. And the state suggests that that term as extraordinary circumstances has been, to the extent it's been defined, or at least the contours of it have been laid out by the Superior Court time and time again, and by this court, are so very, very limited. And in fact, I would point to Your Honor's dissent in Lewis, where that term specifically means circumstances that specifically justify the delay. Those are extraordinary circumstances that we're talking about. It's not extraordinary circumstances about the guy's life or anything else, but that specifically go to justifying the delay in coming before the court on this circumstance. Those have been very, very few and far between. In fact, I found two cases that I could even talk about. One was Lewis and one was DeRoche.
Well, what are the implications for us as an appellate court? If we were to rule as you suggest, does that mean that every time a judge in the Superior Court decides that there were exceptional circumstances and modifies a sentence more than 90 days after the original sentence, that we're going to be in constant review of whether or not that judge properly exercised discretion in determining as a matter of, this is how confusing it is, exercise discretion in determining as a matter of law, that in a capsule says how confusing it is, that these were or were not exceptional circumstances, and are we going to be reviewing sentencing appellate court?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, because I think that if the court sets forth that extraordinary circumstances are so narrowly drawn, as Your Honor suggested in the dissent in Lewis, then there would be so very few circumstances where the court would feel that it can act, especially based on things like rehabilitation. The proper place for that is 4217.
Let me go at this a slightly different way, and this is not the kind of thing perhaps that it's even fair to ask, so you can decline to answer, I guess. It sounds to me as if what's going on here is that the state is frustrated about some judges are more comfortable finding extraordinary circumstances than others, and that the state doesn't have much option, much opportunity to get a better definition before the judges and get its point heard, so to speak. So that you're using this opportunity to say, please give us a ruling that says extraordinary, you can only do this if there are extraordinary circumstances, and here's what extraordinary circumstances are, and here's all they are, so don't ever accept a motion to modify a sentence after 90 days unless, you know, like a gets kind of thing, unless you meet one of these five parameters, and that's really why we're here.
In part, but just as Chief Justice Steele said, is concerned that this court would then become a reviewer of sentence modifications. We are concerned that right now this is so wide open, and especially with TASC. I can tell the court that I have five of these cases pending right now because judges have simply said, we want the state, TASC now says that this guy should get out, even though he's doing mandatory time, even though X, Y, and Z. And we believe, and based on in part by this case and the finding in this case by the lower court that extraordinary circumstances allowed this to occur, the word's getting out. Prisoners are sending these things in saying, one, they're asking, get me into task, because that's my way out. We have specifically gotten applications saying, please give me a task hearing before my sentencing judge. That's the talisman right now. And some have said, I'm in a different program, life skills, but how is that different than Key? So please let me out.
Isn't this something that you could work out with the Superior Court, the way pro se motions were worked out? A pro se defendant would file a motion for a reduction, and there's an arrangement whereby the Attorney General gets notice if the judge is thinking about letting him out of prison. You get copies of that before anybody acts on it so you can respond. Couldn't you put up the same type of process if there's a task recommendation for somebody to get out of level 5 that you're going to get notice? I mean, they'd be happy to give you notice of that, wouldn't they?
Perhaps. Although I can tell you they've been resistant thus far, Your Honor, at least to do it in any meaningful way.
You do know that you've only got a minute left.
I do, and I'll be very quick. But I would suggest, why go down that lane when there's 4217? 4217 is exactly what this is for, and part of my argument that, in fact, the court must lose jurisdiction after 90 days, except in those very, very rare cases, is the fact that 4217 specifically says the Superior Court retains jurisdiction for somebody who's sentenced over a year and then can reduce the sentence. Why would a statute need to say that you retain jurisdiction in those circumstances unless you had lost it at some point? And it does. The Superior Court simply does lose jurisdiction after 90 days and accepts all but the most rare cases. This isn't the case.
Well, if we accept your argument on that, there'd be no jurisdiction even for an extraordinary circumstance, right?
No, because they work together. In the extraordinary circumstance, if the court made a proper finding of extraordinary circumstance in that extremely rare case, then jurisdiction does come back to the court. But otherwise, in the run-of-the-mill rehabilitation case, 4217 is the proper application, and all of the backstops that are with it are in place.
Thank you, Mr. Wallace.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chief Justice Steele, and may it please the court. My name is Bernard O'Donnell. I'm here on behalf of Mr. Sloman, the appellee in this case. Both the state and the defense would like to address, first of all, the question of jurisdiction, the fundamental question. The state wants to talk about whether the Superior Court had jurisdiction to do what it did in exercising its discretion to modify Mr. Sloman's sentence. As I did in my brief, I'd ask the court to consider not only the jurisdiction of the Superior Court, but the jurisdiction of this court, says in this appeal. Does the court, says, have blanket jurisdiction to review the exercise of discretion by the Superior Court under Section 9902 of Title 10? We submit that it does not, insofar as exercises of discretion based upon factual findings in the lower court. Now, the statute itself provides for, says, review of a Superior Court action which is, quote, unauthorized by or contrary to any statute or court rule. The state's argument is twofold. The state argues that, factually speaking, there were not extraordinary circumstances here to modify the defendant's sentence. And second of all, the procedure was irregular because a court commissioner first considered the matter, which was a violation of the court's own rules and statute. Therefore, the court has jurisdiction, and the state may require the court to consider this question and decide this question as a matter of right. We submit not. First of all, in this case, if extraordinary circumstances is a factual question, if that question can be posited to be a violation of a court rule, the court must always exercise jurisdiction to review the factual determination of the Superior Court under Rule 35B, whether there were extraordinary circumstances to consider the sentence modification. So we we'd have a situation whereby, on any occasion where the court granted a sentence modification that was beneficial to the defendant and found that there were extraordinary circumstances which justified the delay in considering the question beyond 90 days, that constitutes extraordinary circumstances, that's contained in the court rule, this court must review that exercise of discretion of the facts. We submit not. Insofar as the second procedural question, the state argued that this wasn't a question of procedure, and what found fault is with the procedures of the Superior Court. Now, there really is no question here, says we submit, that insofar as the commissioner's ruling, etc., the criticism of task, the griping says about task, how this came about, because the judge, the Superior Court judge, gave the state full opportunity to argue its point. It would be tantamount looking at it from the other side if, for instance, a Superior Court commissioner violated my former client's probation and issued a written ruling and sent it to the prisoner based on a written report of the probation officer and imposed the balance of the sentence. And I argued that then I brought it to the attention of the judge. How can this happen, the Superior Court judge? The judge took a look at it and said, well, tell you what, we're going to have a hearing. This is in 2 weeks to consider this matter, and we're going to discuss the allegations against your clients, et cetera. And we went there, and we had a hearing where the merits were discussed. And the judge found that my client was not in the not in compliance with the conditions imposed, and essentially affirmed the commissioner's nullity of an order, but independently found. Could I then argue to this court that this is a highly irregular procedure which has resulted in my client's violation of probation? The rules of the court have been trampled upon. This violation of probation should be overturned. We don't believe so. The court would pragmatically look at it as a situation whereby we had had the due process we were entitled to under the Constitution.
Well, I wonder about that, because if the wrong party, a party without authority, in essence, violated your client, even if the court then held a hearing and said, oh, yeah, there's evidence here that your client was violating the terms of his probation, that never would have gotten before the court, or at least arguably that never would have gotten before the court if the proper procedures had been followed, because he wasn't going to go see his probation officer for another month, and whatever it was that he was doing wrong then, he would have cleaned up or whatever. The facts don't really have to be played out, but my point is that you're suggesting, as long as it ultimately gets before a judge who has authority to do something, it doesn't matter how it got there. Doesn't due process go a little farther than that?
No, I don't believe so. In the former situation, had a court commissioner issued an order, says without authority, violating probation, and a Superior Court judge reconsidered, says the whole matter non-pro-tunk, and found the client was in violation of probation, and really it was not contestable, I'd be explaining to my client there is no purpose in an appeal. I might fail in doing that, as we often are, but there is absolutely no purpose, because we're going to get nowhere in this appeal. We were achieved a fair hearing. So in this sense, the rules, whether it was contrary to any statutes as a court rule, the modification, it did comply, says, with, because there was a hearing and adequate opportunity for the court to consider what had happened. And, in the order, there are two orders here. One has a signature, and one I found in the file, but it appears in all respects like the signed order, and there are notes at the end of the order. And now this 15th day of November 2004. After a hearing at the state's request and during which the state appeared, the order Judge Gebeline of July 24th is adopted, restated, and confirmed as my order. This is Judge Hurley. The defendant has veered completion of his level 5 treatment and the court deems it unwise to now return the defendant to the general level 5 population, which would significantly and adversely interrupt his treatment continuum. We are now in a setting that is different from what may have occurred since 25 years ago insofar as our approach towards sentencing and rehabilitation. I appreciate the state bringing to the court's attention a publication of the CENTAC, Sentencing Accountability Commission. Last year, excerpts of it are contained in the state's appendix. I was reading through the entire appendix, and it points out what the Superior Court must deal with every day insofar as sentencing offenders, the new understanding, the enlightened understanding. This is in the executive summary. Under CENTAC, punishment and treatment are coexisting goals, and by incorporating conditions for treatment into criminal sentencing, judges are allowed to balance the need for punishment, as outlined in sentencing guidelines, with the need for treatment on an individualized basis. Now, what happened? Treatment occurs during sentencing in so many of these sentences. The judge ordered that this defendant be monitored by task for drug treatment. What happened was circumstances changed. Doesn't this happen that often? But the judge took another look at it and realized that what the judge's thoughts is at the time of sentencing had changed based upon this individualized considerations of this case. What makes it extraordinary? Because it's very rare that this happened. I disagree, says, with the state. And the state may have found 5 examples, but I can point to you hundreds of cases that are denials of applications each year. In fact, the Superior Court took extraordinary circumstances. The Superior Court has a form for denials of modification of sentence. You just check off 1 of 5 boxes. There is no form for granting as an approval of sentence. It's got to be done, says, by the numbers. You've got to articulate on the record. You've got to write a written order, says, or opinion. That's extraordinary. Now, what happened with changed circumstances? This is a situation.
Wait a minute, I'm sure I understood that. It's extraordinary that the judge did it, therefore it's extraordinary.
Well, the way it is extraordinary. Yes, sure.
What are the facts here that made it extraordinary in terms of this and your client?
He was nearly through with the key program that the Department of Corrections had put him in, pursuant to the recommendations of the task. And the judge, exercising his discretion, and the state, not just the prosecution, but the state has invested considerable money in the past 10 years in drug treatment, in task. These aren't task. It's not some insidious arm sponsored by the ACLU to free dangerous people. It's funded by the state of Delaware.
Well,
it's an arm of the court.
Would it be extraordinary to put this defendant in the key program, knowing that it would end, to be followed by level 5? Don't they usually do that near the end of the level 5? So that in other words, administratively, what happened here was extraordinary in the sense that people usually go to the key at near the end of the sentence as opposed to the beginning of the long.
Yes, that is true. And Judge Earle, he recognized that. No. It should have been different originally. I wish it had been different. But now that this has happened, now we face changed circumstances, we're going to look at it differently. And it's a weighing process. What was the judge doing here? The judge was weighing. It's an exercise of discretion. And insofar as the cases the state wants to point out, a lot of those cases were decided before CENTAC. But in every one of those cases, the court has upheld the Superior Court's exercise of discretion insofar as sentence modification. I don't know if the state pointed out one, and I couldn't find a single decision where this court had overturned the Superior Court's exercise of discretion. Why? Because the Superior Court is there. It's on the scene. The Superior Court is entitled to exercise discretion because they are the sentencing authority. Otherwise, we're going to get into a...
Let me interrupt you. If I understand you correctly, what you're saying, in essence, is that the whole process of sentencing is discretionary. So therefore, the question of whether extraordinary circumstances exist to modify a sentence is also discretionary. And one judge's idea of an extraordinary circumstance might be, well, this doesn't happen very often, that makes it extraordinary. Another judge's idea of what makes something extraordinary is, well, it's Friday. I don't usually get these applications on a Friday, so it's extraordinary. And it wouldn't matter what each individual judge's sensibilities were as to what it takes to allow a modification of sentence. It's all just, it's up to the trial judge, and that's that. I mean, you're saying that there really are no standards, aren't you?
No, I'm not suggesting that at all, Your Honor. You know, in instance where the judge says, I've received this motion on Friday, therefore I'm going to grant it, that's not rational. It's not a rational basis. That's not weighing. That's not a consideration of the facts. I'm going to consider this because the task officer is wearing a blue suit. That's not rational.
Okay. And maybe I gave you too extreme an example, but the truth of the matter is that a judge, just like a lawyer, just like anybody else, can rattle off a few things and say, I think that's extraordinary. And who's to question that? And where are the standards that go with that?
We submit it's not that difficult. We submit that Judge Herlihy's decision here to exercise his discretion, Judge Herlihy's weighing process, was not irrational. It was an exercise of discretion. And it's entitled. So
extraordinary circumstances are any circumstances that are not irrational?
For the judge on the scene, considering all the facts, the individualized defendant, yes, if it doesn't appear to be irrational, the judge is in possession of all of the factual information, including the changed circumstances. In civil cases, in 60B, under 60B, when a judgment is overturned, the court has traditionally affirmed the Superior Court's exercise of discretion when Superior Court turned down modifications of motion. The court has always upheld the Superior Court's exercise of discretion when the Superior Court has turned down sentence modifications. In 60B, we don't have a situation whereby, well, the court is entitled to wide discretion under 60B to overturn a civil default judgment. Well, it's entitled to wide discretion when the defendant applies for it, but not when the plaintiff applies for it. That brings me to another situation. You know, what could have happened in this case? The court could have imposed a sentence along the lines of, I'm imposing a sentence of imprisonment to be suspended after the completion of drug treatment to be determined by the Department of Corrections or TASC. And this is a minimum 6-month imprisonment under the statute, mandatory 6-month imprisonment. What had happened, he went over to DOC or Gander Hill, and he was evaluated. And some months later, it's beyond 90 days, they said, this gentleman is not appropriate for this program. He would have been out in 6 months had he been appropriate, but he's not appropriate. And they brought that to the attention of the judge and asked that the judge order key. And the judge ordered key. He could be confined under those circumstances for longer than the 6 months imprisonment. Do we have a gripe? No, we don't have a gripe. It wasn't final. I mean, we'd argue it wasn't, we could argue the original sentence was final, but in a sense it's not. It can be modified based upon changed circumstances. And we submit that here, you know, Judge Hurley, in one of those, you know, unusual instances, because the state may be able to point out 5 cases, but it's far more often that sentence modifications are turned down time and time again.
Are you saying that changed circumstances always equal extraordinary circumstances?
No. Now, changed circumstances are something that people say, insofar as 35B, something outside the defendant's control. Circumstances that justifies as the delay. Here, says the court didn't know that he had completed, or that he was placed in the program and nearly completed it until after, says 90 days. So there were circumstances here specific to this case which justified the delay. So that's our contention. Insofar as the standards, the state points out the ABA standards, saying that judgments are final, and they should not be overturned outside of a set time period. Well, there's another provision to that rule, the second provision of the rule, which provides for the modification of the sentences. But more importantly, I'd like to point out there was a subsequent. There's another ABA standard, and it's for the procedures in drug treatment courts, and I believe it's standard 2.27, and it's part of the judicial division of the ABA that issued this standard. And this is essentially substance abuse treatment, what this defendant was ordered to complete, and under those circumstances, that standard summarizes the balancing a sentencing judge has to do in these cases, and oftentimes taking into account changed circumstances based upon individualized considerations of the particular offender. And it's coincidentally, it says the chairman of that commission was your honor. And I believe another member of the seven-member commission was Judge Gebelein. Judges on the scene who are opposing to the sentence are entitled to weigh the factors which justify whether a sentence should be reduced, whether there are extraordinary circumstances or not, based upon what they can appraise at the scene. Unless it's an abuse of discretion because it's essentially irrational. We submit that Judge Hurley's decision is not irrational here. If the court has no other questions, I'd like to conclude at this point.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement.
Please rise.